order. It is Wednesday, February 25th, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you.
So our first bill is Senate File 771, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have before you Senate File 771, a land surveying provisions modification. Senate File 771, which is before you today, is a technical and housekeeping bill that would update some language and terms. It would fix some grammatical errors, make a few corrections on how things are done by the surveyors, and actually removes a contradiction in terms. The bill would help provide guidance and consistency to surveying-related statutes. The proposal before you is a joint effort between the Minnesota Association of County Surveyors, MACS, and the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors, MSPS, that has been vetted with the two associations as well as with other stakeholders throughout the process. With changing technology and requirements within the field of surveying, the associations feel that the timing is right to move forward with these changes in this session. Here to talk more about the need for to change the outline and outlines of statutes and what the changes would do are Goodyear County Surveyor Lisa Haney and Washington County Surveyor Michael Welling.
Who is starting?
Mr. Welling will start.
Mr. Welling will start.
Mr. Welling, please state your name for the record.
Michael Welling, Washington County Surveyor, and I'm representing Minnesota Association of County Surveyors and Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. These statute revisions are basically just going to streamline some statutes where there was cross-references between existing statutes and it was somewhat cumbersome. It will remove a contradiction between two statutes. It's been on the radar screens of the two associations for a couple of years, and the timing is right now with some things that are happening within the industry. There's some issues with some of the material that's used for recording plats, the plat maps on, and that needed to be addressed now, and so the timing seemed right to address some of these other issues. So with that, in the interest of brevity, I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Welling?
Hey, good morning or good afternoon. I'm Lisa Haney. I'm the Goodhue County and Dodge County Surveyor, and I'm also a member of MACS Association of County Surveyors, and we're representing the Joint Committee. And as Mr. Welling said, there's a lot of clarifications. One of the main things that we really needed to address was the material on which we put plats on. The technology has changed, and the availability of the existing material is gone, so that was one of the main reasons why we brought this forward at this time. And we'll sit for any questions you may have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either of the testifiers or Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, is a motion appropriate?
Yes.
I would move that Senate File 771 be recommended to pass. And go to any place?
No. Judiciary.
To judiciary.
Okay. Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 771 be recommended to pass and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee and Madam Chair.
Our next bill is Senate File 397. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I bring before you Senate File 397. This is the second stop for those of you that may have seen this before. Actually, we went through judiciary. What it is the, and some of you probably know about, the bill has been getting some publicity throughout our system here, but it's the Blue Alert system to aid in apprehension of those who are killed or severely injured while serving in law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. And basically, in a nutshell, members, what it is similar to the the Amber Alert system for children, missing children that are abducted. A very successful program that this legislative body was part of the process some years ago in locating children, of course, that are either missing or abducted. And what we have chose to do here is include, unfortunately, we have the occasion where an officer will be either killed in the line of duty or severely injured while performing their law enforcement functions throughout the state. And what this bill does and address is those known suspects, the folks that are, and in some cases are known. The proof is there as to who we're looking for would aid in, of course, putting out literally millions of alerts, where our cell phones or TV alerts, radio alerts. And before I get too much into the weeds with all the alerts that are involved, I'm going to have the specialist that's with me here talk about just exactly how it will work. And with me today is Janelle Rasmussen from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, who actually administers the workings of this bill. So I'll just turn it over to her, Madam Chair, if I could.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I am the Minnesota Amber Alert Coordinator at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And Senator Ingebrigtsen asked that I speak briefly about the existing systems that we have in place at the BCA that we could utilize to implement the Blue Alert system once the criteria and procedures are established, as mentioned in the bill. We have a system called the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, which was established here in 1995, that disseminates through a broadcasting system information to the public. And that system is set up to communicate with law enforcement, with the media, as well as any business who signs up to be a member of the network. And we do that through a fax, email, or text message alert system. We can notify the entire state of Minnesota through any of those means in a matter of 60 seconds or less. So when we send out an Amber Alert, it goes through that system. That's a similar system that we would use for a Blue Alert. We also then have a number of secondary systems that are in place. The COPS Alert is one system. Then we utilize different things like the road signs or a WIA alert that goes out through the IPAWS system, which is what you hear that beeping on your TV or radio if you're listening to that. And then we also utilize social media to also alert the rest of the state of Minnesota. And those are some of the tools that we would also utilize with the Blue Alert system.
Thank you. Did you have another testifier? I have a Susan.
Madam Chair, I expected to have Christine Crittenden here, and quite frankly, my LA could be walking her over at this point in time, but she, along with one other person, actually testified on the first bill, and I think has also testified over in the House on a couple occasions. And what the group that they belong to are the Thin Blue Line Memorial folks in the state of Minnesota who have actually lost loved ones, either husbands or wives or children in some cases to in the line of duty. And I don't see them here right now to testify. I don't think she is here. But Madam Chair, I do have an amendment, a short amendment, if I could.
Yes.
Offer that with regards to the subdivision 2 of the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Wicklin will offer the A-15 author's amendment. I believe it's in your packets. Are there any questions or discussions on the amendment? Senator Dahl?
I would just be curious about the bill. Is this a second stop on the amendment? Excuse me. Was this some recommendation made after judiciary, or you want to talk to me a little bit about it?
Certainly. Thank you for the question.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, the interest came to me just 2 days ago with regards to the Minnesota, adding the Minnesota chapter of the National Emergency Number Association of Public Safety Communication Officials, and when described to me, adding them to the bill that includes the Minnesota Chiefs, the Sheriffs, Commissioner of Transportation, it just seems to make sense. These are the people that are going to be actually doing the dispatching, the initial call, as well as helping to determine the policy moving forward. This is going to be kind of a moving moving issue, if you will. And this particular group, I think, would be that's on the bill now would be aided by the communications people, obviously. It would be, so. That's where it came from, yes. Madam Chair and Mr. Minn. Mr.
Senator Dahl, any further questions? Senator Wicklund renews her motion to pass the A-15 author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Madam Chair, and if I could, I do have folks from that system here that are present if you'd like them to testify. If not, it's pretty straightforward, but I do have some folks here from the Minnesota chapter of the Public Safety Communication Officials, if you'd like that, Madam Chair, but if not necessary, that's fine, too.
I'll leave it up to you, Senator Ingberts.
I guess not. I guess we're okay.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, just moving forward, if I could, being she's not here, I'm certainly, this is a subject that's near and dear to me, 34 years in law enforcement and having one of my partners that was killed in the line of duty. Actually, my wife and I were maid of honor and part of their wedding, and 6 months later I carried him down that same aisle. And so I know what the families are living with when they have these type of situations. And to be able to apprehend somebody that has been this desperate, that has killed somebody or seriously injured an officer who's out there protecting you and I, gives them at least a little peace of mind and knowing that there's going to be that many more eyes. I mean, everybody in the state of Minnesota is going to be looking for the suspect. It certainly doesn't bring back the person, the officer, but it certainly helps. And I think that's the testimony you would hear from them if they were here today. So,
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Ingebrigts. And I'm supportive of the bill. I appreciate your efforts in this area. Just curious, is this a system that's in place in other states, and how's it working, and where did the idea come from?
Senator Ingebrigts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll defer that question to the department.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, this system is in place, Blue Alert system is in place in 20 other states throughout the United States.
And you are Janelle?
Yes.
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm Janelle Rasmussen.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Senator Wicklund moves that Senate File 397 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Finance Committee and Public Safety. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. I think we're at Senator Pappas has Senate File 675.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this is kind of deja vu for me, since 20 years ago I authored a very similar bill for a local process of determining if a county board would like to convert their row officers, their auditors, their treasurers, their recorders to appointed positions. Usually when there's a vacancy is when they do it. And I passed that legislation, the House and Senate passed it, and at that point, it was vetoed by Governor Arne Carlson, former auditor Arne Carlson. That's how long I've been around. You know, everybody knows I just hit my 11,000th day last week. So I moved on with my life. But I did talk to the Association of Minnesota Counties and county officers and said, could you guys work together and see if you could come up with some kind of a process? And to their credit, they did spend time. And so here we are in front of you today for a standardized and a very much local process where the county board, upon a vacancy, can decide if they want to convert their auditor, their treasurer, their recorder to an elected office. It's supported by the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Officers. It doesn't mandate any change in any county. It simply transfers the conversation from here, where they come to us and they say, we have this county board resolution, will you give us authority? And we just about always say yes to them, that they have the conversation locally and they decide if that's the way they want to move forward, and their citizens are involved in that process. So to go through the process, because I'm not that intimately familiar with how this would all work in real life, I have with me Randy Schreifels, who is the Stearns County Auditor.
Senator Pappas, would you like to move your amendment?
Oh, yes. I have an author's amendment that that council suggested, and so I'd like to move the A1 author's amendment.
Is there anything significant?
No, it's just a technical amendment.
All right. Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Carries. So
I have Mr. Schreifels, Mr. Auditor Schreifels.
Thank you, Madam. Randy Schreifels, Stearns County Auditor Treasurer. This would come up in a few different scenarios. If there's a resignation or a death, or if somebody's going to be retiring, the timeline is pretty similar. But before filing, so the year of the filing, early February, the elected official would give notice of their intent if they're going to run or not. If they're not going to run, that would give the county board the opportunity to discuss it and decide if they want to hold a public hearing. They would then publish a notice that would go in for 2 weeks, publish notice. Then the county board would hold a public hearing. Oftentimes, the public hearing may go on for another meeting. If they decide to move forward from there, they would pass a resolution. And then once that resolution is passed, there'd be a 30-day reverse referendum subject to the 10% petition. Once that referendum period is done, if 10% or more petitions are submitted, then the resolution the board has approved would get rescinded and it wouldn't move forward. If there is less than that, then it would not be put on the ballot and it would become appointed.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Bruce Messelt, and I serve as the County Administrator in Chisago County. I have the pleasure of serving for 55,000 citizens, 4 elected row officers, and 5 county commissioners as the administrator, and in many ways more or less the coordinator when you deal with a lot of elected officials. I've also had the honor to represent the Minnesota Association of County Administrators these past 2 years as the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Officers have been crafting the proposed legislation before you today. I am representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Administrators and not in this official position as a representative of Chisago County or their board. I just want to note that I remember fondly growing up in Duluth, taking along with my mother and father as they went to the ballot boxes for over many years and casting their votes for different officials like Mayor Ben Boo, Congressman Jim Oberstar, and even President Ronald Reagan. We have a split household, as you can tell. But for the life of me, when talking to my dad the other day, neither he nor I could recall who we voted for County Coroner. We did have that one time in Minnesota, and of course I'm hoping that your memories are better than mine and you might recall those times. We no longer elect county coroners in Minnesota thanks to legislation that was passed in the early 1970s, which allowed this still very important position to be appointed or contracted with as part of the normal business of county commissioners. We don't have those voters vote for that position. Many states, in fact, most states have followed along in not electing coroners, though Wyoming and North Carolina, for example, still do. In Minnesota also, we don't elect county surveyors, assessors, or engineers, even though there are still a few small states across the United States that do. It's not surprising, then, that when we look at counties, there's over 32 Minnesota counties that represent well over half of all of the state's population, including Chisago County, that have transitioned at least one of the positions of treasurer, auditor, or recorder to an elected versus, or to an appointed versus an elected position. Others have combined those positions depending upon the individual needs of the counties. It is in facilitating this more normal, fair, and natural democratic process of selecting local officials that allows me to testify on behalf of my associations in support of Senate File 675. As Randy talked about, the proposed legislation will go a long way to address significant problems with current statute and the current processes that counties must use. First, most counties actually do not even utilize the existing authority in statute and rather seek affirmative, or in that process, they have to seek affirmative voter approval for the changes to elected versus appointed. Rather, what counties have done is they have had to come forward to the legislature for specific, county-specific legislation authorizing the supermajority of the county board to appoint one or more of these positions and then have that subject to a risk of reverse referendum. This is true for one simple reason, not because these transitions are controversial. In fact, if there is any local controversy, my experience has been that the county board will not pass a resolution simply because they know that it will be controversial and citizens more than likely will overturn that in the referendum process. Rather, it's because citizens' knowledge and interest in these types of positions is quite limited. Personnel decisions are seen as internal and already the purview of the county board, and in proposing voter-approved action and mounting a public education or public information campaign can be quite daunting for a county board, can be expensive, time-consuming, and frankly, it may run afoul of the ethics and the boundaries that elected officials should hold when not being seen as advocating for a particular ballot initiative. This is why we come to the second problem with the current statute. That is, many of the changes from elected to appointed officials only occurs, in fact, when there is a crisis within the county. Typically, that crisis arises because of the failings of one or other elected officials not being doing their job and therefore having a call for more local accountability. It happens because of an unexpected vacancy and the best available successor not being eligible to run for office, or because of major organizational or financial crises threatening the county and therefore challenging the organizational structure. You see, unfortunately, good organizational decision-making, astute succession and personnel planning, and sound fiscal management don't really make for interesting ballot questions. Rarely will local organizations like chambers of commerce or citizens groups take up the mantle of advocating for such changes unless there is a crisis that precedes the question. Finally, current legislation and processes have resulted in a very uncomfortable patchwork of winners and losers. Each county is dependent upon whether the state legislature will approve a specific bill when they seek appointment using reverse referendum versus the current statutory authority. In addition, organizations like AMC, MACO, and MACA are pitted against each other time and time again, and where duly elected local county commissioners are not able to consider possible changes in the makeup of their organization in a timely and orderly fashion. Even though those same commissioners are ultimately directly accountable to the voters and indirectly accountable to the same reverse referendum process that Randy talked about. The proposed legislation found in Senate File 675 represents a very sound and thoughtful approach to Minnesota's efforts to facilitate local control of these specific positions. First, it establishes an orderly transition for the currently elected officials to become appointed officials, if and only if both those officials and the county board wishes to consider just such a transition and the voters agree to it. Second, it ensures citizen involvement and ultimate democratic approval through the same mechanisms of public hearings, supermajority votes by the board, and reverse referendum employed in the currently approved county-specific legislation. Plus, it adds the legislation which requires an automatic reversal if there's a 10% petition, above and beyond what the current statute allows. To be honest with you, this approach already works, as is evidenced by what happened in Lake County last year, when a voter approval or a voter reversal was done based upon a county board action. So we know the reverse referendum process works. Finally, the legislation ahead of you, in front of you, promotes a more fair, balanced, and viable process for all of Minnesota counties to follow, not only by the way of first considering whether or not to seek transition to an appointed position, but then in making the tough decision to place the question either on the ballot, as current statute allows, or by taking the vote and having that subject to reverse referendum. You see, it's my experience, and I believe the experience of the Association of Minnesota Counties and of the Association of Minnesota County Administrators, that when given the local control and authority to make these important, tough decisions, county commissions almost always choose wisely, affording these very same local partners in good governance an additional tool before you today only makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Very thoughtful comments.
Is Mr. Matt Hilgart here to testify? He's on the list. Oh, well, there he comes. Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair members, my name is Matt Hilgart, and I am the Intergovernmental Relations Associate at the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm sorry, I saw your agenda today, and I thought that perhaps Randy and Bruce would be able to testify in place of me. So if that's okay, I'll just echo our same support for the bill. This represents compromise and a multiple years of negotiation and work. And so we think the proposal in front of you is a very good compromise.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Are there any questions for
Madam Chair, there's no criticism. I'm just wanting to understand. So if you have an incumbent county officer and he wants to stay in that, or he or she wants to stay in that position, can they be appointed rather than to have to run for another election?
Who's answering? Mr. Shreffels.
Randy Shreffels, Stearns County Auditor Treasurer, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's up to that person if they want to become appointed. They could try to come to an understanding with the board and the administration and then go through the process. So they still go through the same process, and, you know, I think that is the ideal way for it to happen rather than wait till somebody actually retires to have it, you know, a transition that way where everybody's on the same page. So, yes, that can happen.
Madam Chair, and what would the process be then? Would they have to be a resolution from the board? Or
yep, resolution, 80% of the board would have to support it. It has to be a public hearing. There's a reverse referendum, all the same stuff, yes.
Any other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, we're also including sheriffs involved with this, because it says on line 1.9, when a vacancy occurs in the office of an elected county auditor, treasurer, county recorder, sheriff, county attorney, county surveyor, and the county attorney and the sheriff are both on the ballots every 4 years, and I'm just concerned that we're going to be including law enforcement that and maybe you can give me examples where this has worked for county attorneys and sheriffs to be appointed.
Senator?
No, that's not the intention, Madam Chairman. And Senator, are you looking at 1.9, did you say?
1.9 and 1.10, 110.
Yeah, this is existing law, and I believe that is simply a technical correction. Is Lexi here? Yeah, maybe she could address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. The addition of the language on 1.9 specifies that when there's a vacancy in an elected office, such as the sheriff, this is the process you use to fill that vacancy. So it's not making any changes to the elected offices. It's simply stating vacancy in an elected position follows this process. A vacancy in an appointed position is under a different section. So this bill does not include the coroner, the surveyor, or the sheriff.
Madam Chairman and Senator Anderson, our language really starts on page 2, line 2.28, about the ability to appoint certain officers, and that's the county auditor, county treasurer, county recorder on 2.30.
Madam Chair. Bruce Messelt, Chisago County Administrator. Senator, also to your point, when we've discussed this, we have never included the sheriff or the county attorney in the discussions, and there's really good reason for it. I'll just give you an example. The sheriff, of course, has to be post-certified, so there's a higher threshold for that particular position. A county attorney, of course, has to have a practicing license as well, and so the conversation has been limited to the auditor, treasurer, and recorder.
Any further questions?
Then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 675 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
I have it being sent to Rules Committee, Subcommittee on Elections. Oh, I don't care. Okay.
Maybe it has to go to Judiciary first, then go to Rules.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 675 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say nay.
Good
she carries.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
We are now with Senator Hayden on Senate File 310.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Hayden.
I have Senate File 310, a bill on the study of gender-based violence. Madam Chair, I do have, I think, the A1 amendment that Ms. James is going to help us go over to make sure that we have the bill in the shape that we needed and consistent with the rules of the committee.
Okay, Senator Hayden's moved the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Good. In recognition to the complexities of the culturally unique dynamics of gender-based violence in various Asian ethnic communities, Senate File 310 requests that the state funds a two-year study on the nature, scope, and prevalence of violence against Asian women and children in Minnesota. A multidisciplinary advisory group will oversee the study in 2017 and report back on the study's findings and recommendations. Senate File 310 is critically important for several reasons. I'll share with you three of them. First, domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence in the Asian Pacific community have long been considered by most to be acceptable. At best, it's considered private matters to be handled within the family, the extended family, the clan system, or the ethnic community. Secondly, national data indicates that gender-based violence in this community is occurring at the rate twice the national average. Third, and anecdotally, we are hearing from victims, community-based organizations, and others that violence against Asian women and children are happening in multiple forms, oftentimes unbeknownst to even law enforcement until someone has been severely hurt, killed at alarming rates. As state government, I think we lack the understanding of the nature of this issue, and we need the victims and survivors of this community to help us. Senate File 310, if passed, will yield information we believe will enable stakeholders and more appropriately and consequently an effective response to victims and educate silent witnesses and perpetrators in our Asian and Minnesotan community. So I want to thank you for this time. I'm going to introduce Ms. Herr from the Council of Asian Pacific Islanders as our first testifier.
Ms. Herr, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Sia Herr, and I am the Executive Director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. As most of you know, I've been Executive Director for less than 2 years. In my short time at the Council, our community members and community-based organizations have repeatedly brought to my attention the scarcity of quantitative data, as well as the scarcity of culturally and linguistically appropriate resources for victims and survivors of gender-based violence from the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. The few existing statistics, coupled with anecdotal stories we have been hearing, paint an alarming picture of this issue as it relates to the Asian American community. In response, our council is working with Senator Hayden to pass Senate File 310. Our hope is that the findings and recommendations of the study we are asking for will yield the following. One, that it will provide culturally specific information and clarity to stakeholders on the true state of Asian women and children as it relates to gender-based violence. to influence decisions around best practices and allocation of resources to appropriately respond to victims and aggressively educate perpetrators and communities, and three, create a structure that will begin to dismantle the process of breaking the culturally unique cycle of victim blaming, shaming, and silencing. Our council has been busy preparing to advance this bill. Between last session and today, we have shared the draft with a broad group of stakeholders, including both Republican and Democratic legislators, the governor's office, the State Department commissioners, victims and survivors in our community, city and county governments, sheriffs and police chiefs, Asian American domestic violence advocates on the ground, as well as mainstream advocacy groups, and of course, our Asian organizational and cultural leaders. I believe you also received a handful of letters of support from organizations such as the Asian Endowment at the St. Paul Foundation and the Minnesota Asian American Bar Association. On behalf of some of our most vulnerable women and children, we at the Council ask that you support Senate File 310. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herr. Mayor Lundy, welcome to the committee.
Jeff Lundy, Mayor of the City of Brooklyn Park, here to testify as well. A little background about my city. My city is undergoing tremendous demographic changes. We are now a minority-majority city. 25% of our city is African, West African. 18% is Asian American. 6% Hispanic. The changes have been dramatic in our city, and through that time, we have actually had tremendous success using intelligent data. We have lowered crime by 20% despite having 25,000 more people. We have lowered youth crime by 41%. And we've also, in the last 5 years, put a significant effort into increasing the convictions, domestic abuse crimes, and we've increased that by 240%. The one thing that we lack in a lot of these matters is good, intelligible, actable data, something that we can derive good police policies, policies that add victims into the equation, not just the perpetrators, that add families to it as well. And so as a city, I stand before you to tell you that this is extremely important to our next steps, which is how can we get into our communities. 20% of my city was born outside the U.S., and that adds a little added burden to our city as we try to tackle some of these crimes, which maybe are acceptable in other countries but are not acceptable in ours. And so this study would help us come up with policies and make a partnership with the members of the community rather than us trying to force our way in. And so we would ask for your support.
Thank you. Is Dr. Vang? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Padre Vang. I'm an assistant professor of social work in the St. Catherine University, University of St. Thomas School of Social Work. Prior to this, I was a social worker for 8 years, and I worked with women victims of domestic violence as an advocate and a group therapist. I am also a mother and a wife who married at the age of 17, became a mother at the age of 18, and was divorced by the age of 23. I am also a member of the Hmong Minnesota community, the largest Asian ethnic group here in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to talk about one example of how culture impacts Asian American women. However, very little data exists regarding these cultural factors, nor do current systems adequately address cultural factors. I will be talking about early marriage as one cultural factor. Early marriage continues to be practiced in many of our Asian American communities, especially in the Hmong American community. As a researcher and a university professor, I have conducted several researches about the experience of Hmong women in relation to their intimate relationships. I have published papers about the impact of teenage marriage on Hmong women. The women in my small studies who married in their teens reported that intimate partner violence, more intimate partner violence than women who married in early adulthood. The reason early marriage is associated with higher rates of intimate partner violence is likely that families who still ascribe to more traditional practices are likely to encourage and allow their sons to marry young girls. Younger wives are perceived as being easier to control and subsume into the clan structure. Hmong tradition is patriarchal, where women have few rights and where violence against a woman is used as punishment when it is perceived that she has disobeyed her husband and or her in-laws. Women's voices are not recognized, and women lack the power to make decisions affecting their own lives. For Hmong women, culture states that if a woman leaves her husband, no one will bury her when she dies. There has been no research on this phenomenon. However, there have been cases highlighting this issue, such as the 2013 case of Banya Vu in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who was murdered by her husband. Hmong women, upon our deaths, need our husband's clan members to facilitate our journey into the afterlife. Mrs. Vu's husband's clan refused to conduct her funeral, citing that she and her husband were already estranged at the time of her murder. Should a Hmong woman leave her marriage, no one can, nor will they, facilitate her journey due to cultural rules around spirituality. She is left to languish between earth and the afterlife. This cultural issue impacts women's decisions to speak up about their abuse, or even to leave their abuser. Therefore, a Hmong woman would rather stay in an abusive relationship than risk isolation and exclusion. This is a cultural factor that is largely recognized in the larger community, that is rarely recognized in the larger community. This is only one example of a Hmong tradition that impacts intimate partner violence and Hmong women's decisions to seek safety. There are many other similar examples in other Asian communities around cultural traditions, shame, and secrecy around intimate partner violence that I do not have the time to share with you today. When we speak of these stories, the question that we get is, where is the data to support this? There is a scarcity of data that is collected by researchers or government entities. There are only the stories told by the women themselves. Some argue that we are now Americans and the traditions are fading away. While this may be true in some families, it still remains that traditions surrounding the treatment of women are hard to change in most communities, as we all know. I, as a researcher, a Hmong wife and mother, and a member of the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, can attest to the fact that there is a lack of research and understanding about the cultural factors impacting Asian women who face intimate partner violence. Thus, they continue to struggle in silence. So I am here today to ask you to help stop this cycle of systemic gender-based violence and support Senate File 310. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the testifiers? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you, Senator Hayden, for bringing this forth. And I really want to thank Ms. Herr, who's the executive director, because she visited me in my office. And I somehow got on the subject of the area of the state that I came from, which was a very impoverished area up by the Canadian border. And she told me what was occurring there. And I see in the bill, we're talking about studying international abuse of marriage, because she made me aware that there are mail order brides in the area that I come from. And so I immediately texted a good friend of mine that lives there. And she said, well, she had never heard that. And she did some checking, and yes, it's true. She discovered that there were Filipino women who had been brought there as brides. And let me tell you, if you go there, there are no support services. It's very remote. And so I was so troubled by this, and I've been corresponding with my friend there, and she's been interviewing people there. And she says, yes, it is true. And there are many, not just one marriage, but it goes, I mean, if it doesn't work out, then she's done, and then they get another one. And they're sent to work in some of the places up there, like Polaris, et cetera. But I just don't think there's any scope of what might be happening in Minnesota that would be considered international abuse of marriage, because I think that these people, where would they go? And they wouldn't go back to the Philippines. It was very troubling to me. So I'm so glad to see this bill come forth,
because I think we need to track these people. They're just meeting in homes because there's no support group for them. And it's very troubling to me. I'm going up there this summer, and I intend to look into this with some people. And so I just thank you so much for bringing this to my attention and to Senator Hayden for authoring this bill.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, it says on line 1.13, the working group, the Commissioners of Human Services, Health, and Public Safety, and then going to 1.14. And then your new amendment that just came in was that the Commissioner of Human Services will designate one member to serve as the chair of the working group. And I flip over to the backside of this bill, and on line 2.16, it says the Commissioners of Human Services, Health, and Public Health. I'm wondering if that's a mistake.
Senator,
it should be Public Safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, because I don't think we have a Commissioner of Public Health. We have a Commissioner of Health. Mm-hmm. So I would look to Ms. James to help me.
Ms. James.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, and members, I think that's a good catch. So on page 2, line 16, delete health and insert safety. What was that?
The second health.
Oh, the second health, yes. Delete the second occurrence of health and insert safety.
Public safety.
So I'd move that, Madam Chair.
Is there any further discussion? Senator Hayden moves the change on 2.16 after public, eliminate health and add safety. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, thank you for bringing this legislation forward. I look forward to I'm just curious, as it says in your amendment that you're going to add 8 members of the working group must be Asian Pacific Islander, and you're appointing 15 members representing the following groups. So I'm just wondering, because from 1.16 down to 1.23, you have 8 designations already, and then within the community leaders, I'm not sure where these 8 members of the Asian Pacific Islander are going to fit in. If that's, I know 8 and 8 make 16. I understand that, but I'm just wondering how the dynamic of that working group is going to take place, and where those 8 people will fit in that you've brought in through your amendment.
So, Senator Anderson, Madam Chair, I'll let Ms. Hur kind of walk us through that a little bit.
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if I recall correctly, we decided that the group would consist of 15 members, and we thought that given the diversity of the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community, and given the fact that while we want to include some of the largest communities under our umbrella at the table, we also want to make sure that we don't leave out some of our most vulnerable communities, meaning that they recently arrived here in the state and that they are small enough that they're not considered the top 10 largest communities. We just decided that eight members who are of Asian descent at the table of 15 would cover enough of the key aspects of the group that we want to have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hur, could those 8 members of the Asian Pacific Islander be included in the other groups that are outlined here from 1.16 to 1.23? Is that a possibility?
Ms. Hur?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, yes, absolutely. Service providers, I'm thinking of, for example, the executive director of Hmong American Partnership would be, she's also a cultural leader, a community leader, as well as an organizational leader. And that organization is the largest nonprofit serving the Asian American community here in the state. It is also one of the few nonprofits providing any kind of services to victims and survivors of gender-based violence.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we've talked about a commission, we've talked about a task force, and now we have a working group, and I'm just wondering if there's a definition for the working group.
Is
there a definition, Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, there are definitions for certain kinds of things. I'm not sure there's a definition for working group, but it's one of the kinds of entities that agencies create on a regular basis. We call them working groups, and they – let me just look for the statute site to see if there is one for – if there is a definition for working group.
Thank you.
It'll take me a second.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Pappas had a question.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, mine was the same as Senator Anderson, that I was just assuming that advocate survivor service providers could – community leaders, et cetera, could be Asian.
Absolutely.
Excuse me.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't really need that right now, but just for future, it
sure,
would be
absolutely.
Nice to, you know, if Ms. James could get back to me, that'd be great. So.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, one thing I wanted to say about this bill that I'm really pleased about how specific it is and how it's very clear about what the goals are. It's very clear that we want a report, that we want draft language on the recommendations. You know, the dates are very clear. The chair is very clear. I think that is very helpful with us as we look at doing working groups, task force, whatever, is that we are really very specific that we want to hear back and we want to know what the results are. This is not just a way to bury a bill. This is information that is really important for us to have. So, and thank you to our staff for really pushing that and our chairs for remembering to do that too.
Thank you. Ms. James does have a definition for us now.
See, I talk long enough.
Madam Chair and members, actually, there is no definition of working group. That's not one of the defined kinds of agencies. Section 15.012 has a definition for councils and commissions and committees and legislative commissions, authorities, and advisory task force, but not for working group. It's sort of a catch-all.
Okay. Do you have anything further to add, Senator Hayden?
Well, no, Madam Chair. I just think that we've had great testifiers in there. And I want to thank the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans for bringing this to my attention. I do agree with Senator Pappas that we look forward, hopefully if this moves forward, to gathering this information and reporting this back not only to this committee and the legislature but the rest of the state. I think there are a lot of vulnerable women and children that were unidentified that this bill hopes to bring some shed some light on.
Thank you. Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 310 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Health and Human Services Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I believe we're going to jump to Senator Lurie, if that's okay.
That's fine with me.
Thank you. Senator Lurie. Senate File 474.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 474 is another task force. It is a healthcare regulatory review task force. This is our second hearing on it, and so the state and local aspects are, of course, the building of the task force. Briefly, I'll describe what Senate File 474 does. It establishes a task force to review and assess the state regulatory and oversight structure for health plan companies and other related healthcare entities. The purpose of this task force is to examine the operational licenses for health plan companies and the differences in the statutory and regulatory requirements for each license and determine whether there are ways to maximize administrative efficiency and regulatory simplification and to streamline the regulatory process while maintaining quality and stability. The task force shall also review new healthcare delivery models and payment systems that are occurring throughout the state currently and determine whether there is sufficient regulatory oversight for these new delivery and payment systems to ensure geographic accessibility, quality assurance, price stability, and consumer protections. Real briefly, Subdivision 1 describes the purpose of the task force and the extent of the chapters that we would be reviewing. Subdivision 2 describes the membership of the task force. Subdivision 3 specifies that the task force will be staffed by the Commissioner of Health and gives the task force the authority to enter into contracts to provide analytic and evaluation services as needed. Subdivision 4 describes the duties of the task force, and Subdivision 5 requires that the task force report back to the legislature on the results of their review and assessment and with any recommendations by February 15, 2016. With that brief review, I'm happy to stand for questions, but I would like to add that I would like to offer an A5 amendment that could be drafted or handed out, rather. We did hear some concerns when we first heard this from health plans, and I'm trying to respond to that. I don't know if I don't think it's perfect yet, but the A5 amendment begins to address some of those, and they're kind of a work in progress. I can either take questions on the bill or describe the A5 and what the issues behind it were. It's up to the committee.
Senator Laurie, would you explain the amendment, please?
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment names the task force of first off, and does a couple of cleanup things. But the core of it begins on page one, line 6 through 1.8, and basically the concerns centered around two things. Number one, that are basically at the core of both of this. This is an incredibly complex set of numerous chapters of law. And so that basic concern, which I'm sensitive to, resulted in us thinking through a little bit better two aspects of this bill. Number one, we're extending the timeline for this workforce to deliver a report by an additional year. So we're changing the report due date from 2016 to 2017 to give that additional review time so that we're not trying to push this incredibly complicated process. And then the second piece that we do, again on line 1.6 to 1.8 of the A5 amendment, is include the contracting for a legal summary and analysis of the current regulatory structure and operational requirements for health plan companies and the other related entities, the new payment models and things, the ACOs, the buying value rather than volume payment models. And so the concept here is that we would actually try to bring in some really technical, detailed, largely legal expertise to really unpack how we got where we are today, to bring this task force up to speed and give them the tools to have the more lengthy and fruitful conversation about what ought to be included in the final recommendation that is, again, pushed out a year. So that's the first attempt. I consider this A5 a work in progress toward those general goals. I think that we probably should add a little bit more specificity about what that initial report should look like and how it would be staged in the conversation and whatnot. So I'm open to that as we move forward, but I did want to respond to the one overarching concern that it is a very complex area. Give it more time and a little bit of really good expert scoping at the beginning.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, I would move the A5 amendment.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. Amendment passes. Are there any other questions or comments on the bill? Senator Thompson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Senator Laurie, your amendment did address one of the concerns I had personally on the issue of the timing of it. As I look at the makeup of the group, I know that I've heard from some of the health plans that they're a little concerned there's not a little bit more insurance expertise on this, a little bit more medical expertise. Is that something you're willing to, I don't have an amendment prepared or anything along those lines, is that something that you're willing to work on as we go along?
Well, I mean, we can certainly have the conversation, but I believe that this is pretty fairly balanced. I mean, our what I'm shooting for here, what is proposed, is four legislators, equally, DFL and Republican, one from the House, one from the Senate, of each side of the aisle, four consumer reps, and eight from industry, four from the insurance industry, four from the provider side of the industry, one employer, one labor, and four commissioners. I think that the legislators and the commissioners, the four consumers and eight industry, I really felt it was a pretty good balance, but I wouldn't be surprised to have to kick that around a little bit and talk about it as we move through the process.
Thank you.
Are there any further? Yeah. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, wasn't there a task force of some sort that was in place before we got to the place of our President Minshew and the ACA? Wasn't there something that was in place that was looking into all the dynamics of health care and things like that? I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on what the outcome of that task force was as far as what the report was back to the legislature.
Senator Lori?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I believe you're referring to the Health Insurance Exchange Task Force. It was, it was about building, specifically about building an exchange. This is actually about taking a look at the incredibly complex regulatory structure that we have over health insurance much more broadly than an exchange. Our healthcare statutory regulatory framework has been built up over many, many decades with different points in time when things changed, and we have the tendency around here to write a new chapter about this new development in reforms, and that's what we keep doing, and we've added all of these chapters. So we have managed care organizations, we have HMOs, we have county-based purchasing, we have, all these different chapters that have different regulatory structures, different oversight from the Department of Commerce to the Department of Health to the Department of Human Services, and now, as you mentioned, to Minshew, Minnesota Management and Budget with the CGIP program, all of these different agencies interacting in different ways with how we govern health insurance, and it really doesn't make sense to anyone, and it's a very backwards-looking view of a regulatory structure, and it is so complex that it has been ignored for decades. The last time that we actually tried to take a good look at this was, I think, in the 80s, and they gave up at that time, and so here we are, several decades later, and haven't really done this deep conversation about what it is that we're looking at. How did we get where we are? What is it where we are? What are some of the problems navigating it? And how do we move forward? Is it a good idea to, and I will say right off the bat, I don't have an end goal in mind. I don't know, I don't have this big vision that I'm trying to bring about. I think this is just a very long overdue conversation regarding a particularly complex set of regulations around a very important business and one that interacts with people in their daily lives. And so we as legislators ought to, roll up our sleeves and do the hard work of getting behind what this is and whether it's working the way it should be.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, with no end goal in mind, I'm concerned that with the task force that we've talked about, we talked about a task force versus a commission here a couple of weeks ago or a week ago, I don't remember which, and relating back to the task force that had taken up the issue that we had talked about then, the task force didn't come up with a solution, or at least it fell through the cracks. I'm concerned that, we put these groups together, these task force or whatever, and if there is no kind of an end goal, I mean, it's just like a team going in to play in a game. If you don't have an end goal in mind, what are you working for? And to hear you say you don't have an end goal, I'm concerned.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, well, I'm glad you brought that out because I'm I must not have been articulate enough. The end goal is to have a structure that works a lot better than it does right now. What I'm trying to say is I don't have a master plan that I'm personally trying to advance. Our current regulatory structure is an absolute mess, and there's nobody who wouldn't agree with that, and we need to take, it's a lot of work to get in there and try to figure out what it is and how it should look. I'm trying to say, you know, many states have looked at this and done very different approaches to trying to streamline and make a regulatory structure that makes sense. And they've taken different approaches. And I don't have one of those approaches in mind. I'm open to the conversation. The end result would be at least a recodification to make sense and put these statutes and make it a little bit more readable and understandable by individuals trying to use our current structure, and maybe some significant reforms, and then also some of the new payment models actually have some incredibly important ramifications to our provider industry, our payer industry, and the people of Minnesota, and they have very little space in our statute books right now. I mean, DHS is doing good work with the integrated health partnerships, the IHPs, and these new payment models, but they have very broad authority to just go and enter contracts, and it's in those contracts where all of the details are worked out, and it's worthwhile to look at what those look like and whether we ought to bring those into the statute books, incorporate that into the entire structure. Those are kind of happening rather quickly, and we haven't really done a thorough analysis. We needed them to be flexible as they worked, and they've been working very well. They've saved the state fiscal quite a bit of money and really served people in a much better way. But I think it's time to, you know, put those in the context of the broader industry structure and see whether it's time to give them a little bit more of a place in statute and really dig into these issues.
Any other discussion? Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 474, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Now, Alex. Senator Johnson has Senate File 737.
Madam Chair and Senate File 737 is Board of Cosmetology. It's a bill that is also supported by the Professional Association. I have with me today Eva Strauss, who's the director of Board of Cosmetology, and Jim Hurst, who represents the Salon and Spa Professional Association. The bill is generally, I would call it quite simple, because there are a lot of technical housekeeping changes here. They do create a new advanced practice esthetician license, which for those of you who might not know, it's having to do with skin. And it creates an expedited application process and modifies the board's licensing fees. There is an amendment that I would like to have added, the A15 amendment. Would move that amendment.
Senator Johnson moves the A15 amendment. Is there any discussion? Everybody have it? It's in your packet. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment has really came from the Professional Association, Mr. Hurst, and the original bill came from the Board of Cosmetology. So Gina Strauss will start explaining the full bill, and then we'll let Mr. Hurst describe the amendment.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gina Stausen. Again, I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. For the purposes of this committee, this bill, as Senator Johnson said, is mainly technical in nature, and I will just begin by going through the sections. Section 1 is a technical change for general terminology used to better reflect the scope of why the board exists. Section 2, it updates the definition of a manager to clearly identify who a manager is, as current law is not accurate. Moving on to Section 3, specifically lines 2.1 to 2.8, this is where we create the new license type for the advanced practice esthetician, as well as giving the board 2 years to undergo the full rulemaking process to create educational licensing, as well as scope of practice requirements. And again, this license is important. They're for services only performed on the surface of the skin, but are beyond a routine makeup and facial application. In sections 4 through 7, the board uses these definitions throughout statute and rule, and feel it's important to have a clear and concise definition to ensure licensees understand their responsibilities. In Section 8, this is a technical change to accurately reflect the roles of the board employees. Under Section 9, the board is on a 3-year license fee schedule, which is unique in comparison to other professional licensing boards. The fee schedule is getting cleaned up to make it more concise. Fees are changed in these lines. However, no new fees are added except for voluntary additional services. The board itself hasn't asked for a fee increase in almost 10 years when the board was moved out of the Same Department thing. Of Commerce and was created. Moving on to lines 4.3, this is the fee was set to be variable, and we would just like to ensure that it's a standard reinspection fee for the actual cost of one. Lines 4.19 to 4.2, it's a technical change to make the language more concise. 4.23 is to change the name of the permit to more accurately reflect the type of permit it is, modify the license fee, and state the duration of the permit. 4.25 is a technical change to accurately reflect the national standard name for this type of letter. 4.27 is to remove a fee that the board does not charge. 4.30 to 4.31 is a technical change, moving the fee from one part of the statute to the fee schedule to make the fee easier to find. 4.32 to 4.33, it creates a new fee for applicants to pay if they wish for an expedited license. The expedited application process is defined on later lines and will be discussed in a minute. 4.34 to 3.5, this creates a fee to support the approval of continuing education providers to review their classes, lesson plans, and learning objectives, and to keep an online list of providers in their classes. In sections 10 and 11, it's a technical change to streamline the options for processing an application within 15 business days. In sections 12 and 13, this is the language where we create the expedited application to process licenses that pay the fee in 5 days or less, as well for military applicants. Section 14 and 15, it's a technical change to remove the active voice and better reflect the scope of the board's rules. Section 16, this is the fee that was moved to our fee schedule. Section 17 is another technical change to remove the active voice and clarify the types of salon licenses the board issues. Section 18, this is a technical change, specifically on line 7.2. We would like to add the words workers' compensation to make it easier for licensees to know that statute 176.182 refers to workers' compensation. Line 7, 6 to 7, 9 is duplicate law, therefore just removing it. Section 19 is technical changes, specifically 7.26 is a change of a word. 8.7 to 8.9 clarifies that a school must have a designated manager when operating and applying. Section 20 is a technical change to encompass the entire Human Rights Act. Section 21 is giving the board the general rulemaking authority to write the rules for the advanced practice esthetician license. Section 22 designates that the new revenue collected will go back to the board to support the new legislation and improve public protection and services to both the public and the licensees. And Section 23 is a technical instruction for the reviser.
Thank you.
That concludes the original bill explanation. So if we want it, you want to go ahead with the amendment discussion or explanation?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I am here today on behalf of the Salon and Spa Professional Association, a Minnesota trade association that has been in existence for nearly 90 years, representing cosmetologists in the state of Minnesota. I want to start by stating that our association is supportive of the original bill that was introduced by Senator Johnson on behalf of the State Board of Cosmetology. We have a very proud record of working in unison with the State Board in furthering our goals of enhancing and bettering the professionalism of cosmetologists in the state of Minnesota. The amendment that was offered up and adopted is a expansion upon the existing continuing education requirements for cosmetologists in the state. You may recall, and it was with Senator Johnson's assistance a couple years ago, that the initial continuing education requirements were enacted, and I am proud to inform the committee that those classes have been very well received and very much welcomed by practitioners, and it has been very eye-opening to them because many practitioners have, shall we say, over time have somewhat forgotten what they have learned initially in college years back, and certainly the profession is an evolving one that changes over time. And certainly those classes have been very well received, as I said, and very beneficial, not only for the practitioner, but of course for the general public that they serve. The expansion of the continuing education would take effect in the year 2017. This is 3 years exactly after the date of the initial continuing education. And as was mentioned earlier, license cycles are on a 3-year cycle. So continuing education is a condition of renewal. And so this would match up ideally after the first 3-year period has already occurred. The purpose for expanding this into what is going to be a focus on product chemistry, proper use of machines and implements, as well as business management, human relations, and techniques specific to the license held, because keep in mind, sometimes cosmetologists are not only just cosmetologists, but sometimes they are strictly nail technicians or strictly estheticians, who are those who work on skin care and things related to that. These classes would be an additional 4 hours specific to that, in addition to the existing continuing education for health and sanitation. Furthermore, the providers of this would be expanded to also include licensed salons, and we envision that there would be participation by a number of manufacturers and product distributors, which I want to point out towards the top of page 2. On line 3, there is a specific product sales prohibition during any continuing education class. That's only during the class. Certainly, it would not be prohibited after the class is concluded. Other than that, the rest of the amendment that's been incorporated into the bill basically updates and makes necessary revisions to make it conform with this anticipated change effective in 2017. And in closing, this is not unique to Minnesota. There are a number of other states that do require continuing education and certainly specific to this enhanced or areas that I have described. And for your information, most other states that do require this, the yearly average is anywhere from between 3 to 8 hours per year. With this proposal, it would then be on average of about 2.6 hours or just under 3 hours per year. And it is certainly in conforming with the policy that the legislature enacted years ago that starts out in the cosmetology chapter that finds that not only the health safety of the people are best served by licensing the practice of cosmetology, but also due to the use of chemicals, implements, apparatus, and other appliances, and special skills requiring special education. With that, I conclude my remarks and would be glad to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Hurst? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question related to the cost of these continuing credits. What is the cost for a person to complete these credits on average?
Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray. Currently, the continuing education costs for the existing continuing education ranges from about anywhere from $30 to $50 total for the 4 hours. We envision this to be no more than that, and actually probably much less than that, anticipating participation by product manufacturers and distributors, and certainly with the participation of salons and certainly chain salons, I suspect, although I can't say definitively, that the cost would be significantly less than the current cost of the $30 to $50 for the existing 4 hours currently.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Ms. James could help me on the amendment. It says that there's a repealer on here of Subdivision 6, 155A.23. Unless the testifier knows about that, I'm interested to know what's
Madam
being
Chair.
Repealed.
Madam Chair, it was an oversight on my part. There were two sections of this amendment that came from the Board of Cosmetology that Ms. Strauss would explain, and that would be the first four lines on page one and the repealer. So if you would allow her to explain those two sections of the amendment, and it would answer Senator Anderson's question about the repealer.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the repealer it's a definition that's been advised by the reviser, and actually we worked with Stephanie. It's law that isn't necessary, and it was advised to be repealed. It's just the definition of licensed practice, and the assumption is when you have a license working in a licensed salon, you don't actually need to define licensed practice. So it was asked to be deleted. That's the repealer. And then on the top page, sorry to go from back to front, on 1.2, we just had a technical error in the way our fees are broken out is there's a total fee and then two parts to a fee, the license fee and the application fee. The total was right, but the license fee was off by $5, so our math wasn't good in that one. So that's just a minor change there. And then 1.3, on page 5, line 9, we were referring to subdivision 5A, and that got renamed to subdivision 6, so the reference was incorrect. And that's the two changes there.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Not seeing any. Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 737 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Well, we have one left, Senator Wicklin. Senate File 504.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I do have Senate File 504. It's expedited temporary licensure for members of the military. This proposed statutory change will authorize the issuance of a temporary license to a qualified individual who could be an active duty military member, the spouse of an active duty military member, or a veteran who has left service in the 2 years preceding the date of license application and has confirmation of an honorable or general discharge status. This change comes about because of a law passed in 2014, which created this expedited and temporary licensing process. But when they created it, it didn't put into statute a process for the licensing boards to actually enact this. So we're coming back this year to get the statute changed and make it possible for these temporary licenses to be issued. We started out, the proposal came to me from the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, and the bill has been heard in the Health and Human Services and Housing Committee. As we worked on the bill, it was learned that there are several boards that have the same requirement to make this change in statute, and so we felt it was best to combine all of the same type of language repeated for the different boards that need this. And you heard reference to it in the previous bill for cosmetology members. So it's similar to that. And I have the board that we're actually concerned with in this committee is the Board of Barber Examiners, not the other boards. And so I have the executive director from the Board of Barber Examiners here with me, and she can provide additional information specific to that board.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Thora Fisco, and I'm the executive secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. And in the bill, the barber examiner portion starts on page 6, line 6.24. Basically, what we're doing is taking the language that was added to our statute last year. We're putting the fees into 154.003, where all the other barber board fees are, and then just slightly amending 154.11 to bring us into accordance with last year's statute, which created section 197.4552, and so that we can issue those temporary military licenses under that statute. It's basically a technical housekeeping kind of thing to make this possible.
Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund moves that Senate File 504 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee in Health and Human Services. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
That was it. Madam Chair, I don't think that there is no financial impact to the bill. Is it certain that it needs to go to Health and Human Services Finance?
That's what the committee chair says.
If I may, all the financial was taken care of last year. So there's no fee changes or anything here.
They requested it.
Okay.
They probably didn't realize that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, business is completed. Thank you.